Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This problem of engineering economic growth through the granting of easy credit, stimulating business with infusions of cash, or the equally challenging task of building economic efficiency through enforced discipline and austerity has once again bedeviled the nations of the European Union. Greece is at a crossroads and seems to have decided to go it alone. The European Union is suddenly not the unified collection of nations behind a single currency, the euro. What is particularly confounding about this crisis is that none of it is a secret. The Greek economy couldn't be more different than the economy of Germany. It's a difference between simple and complex. Economies can be viewed as massive exchanges of products and services, but a new and perhaps more useful way to see them is as vast networks exchanging information and ideas. Cesar Hidalgo believes that information is the key to recognizing and measuring economic growth, a process that the MIT professor outlines in his new book, Why Information Grows, The Evolution of Order from Atoms to Economies.
As a physicist, you always try to think of the world in relatively simple terms. And I think originally people, if you go back to the time of the ancient Greeks, you were thinking of the world in terms of things, you know, like objects or like the whole idea of atoms. Then eventually with the Industrial Revolution, the zeitgeist changed more into that of energy, to that of, you know, creating motion through machines such as steam engines or eventually combustion engines. And now in the 20th century, we realize that it's not just about things or moving things around, but it's about the way in which things are arranged. And a very easy way to illustrate this is to think about how our world looked like 100,000 years ago and how it looks now and what has changed. And if you think about it, our world 100,000 years ago had the same atoms that it has today. The only thing that has changed in our civilization is the way in which we have ordered those atoms. By rearranging some building blocks that already existed in our planet, we have created, you know, our cities, our transportation networks, our communication networks, all of our products such as our shoes and our clothes and all of the devices that we use at home. So in some way, the evolution of economies is the evolution of physically embodied order.
And when you begin to look at economies and equate them to the complicated reordering of, say, electronic systems, what do you discover? What distinguishes, say, the economy of a Germany or the United States and the economy of a China or Indonesia?
So if we agree that what economies are doing is producing order in the form of objects that then people can transact, you know, to augment their capacities, and that's how they obtain value, then we can think that economies are computers, and these computers are embodied in social and professional networks. So the question of economic wealth becomes a question of, well, which are the economies that have the largest computational capacities? So an economy like that of Germany or that of Japan or that of Sweden or that of the US, which are sophisticated computers, are economies that eventually have the ability to produce a diverse set of ordered things, you know, from aircraft engines to, you know, like even agricultural products and mining. Other economies that are simpler would only be able to produce like the simpler forms of order, like the ones that you produce through agricultural activities and mining, but not the ones that you produce through manufacturing or through the development of software. So in some way, when you're thinking about economies as computers, you can infer that different economies have different computational capacities based on the mix of products that they make. And by looking at the mix of products that they make, you can infer which computers are more powerful than others. And eventually the data shows you that the economies that are more powerful computers tend to be richer. And when they're not yet rich, they tend to grow faster than the ones that are less sophisticated computers.
Let's look at a couple of computers that are in the news. I mean, you've got the issue of Greece in the EU, and then you could take a country about the same size, Finland, which, you know, is in a very different geographic zone, but certainly has much more success with higher order products and services than Greece has. What would explain Greece's inability, it seems, to climb out of a relatively simple economy to something more diverse?
So when you look at the data that we've looked at, and this is data that goes through the last 50 years and is data that focuses on the mix of products that countries make, you can actually see that Greece was in trouble already back in 2004 and 2005. Why? Because when you look at the mix of products that a country makes and you look at the mix of products that Greece was making, you realize that that product mix was compatible with a country that had, on average, a much lower level of income. And therefore, given what Greece was producing, it was not going to be able to sustain the level of income that it had now, which was coming, obviously, now we know, from borrowing. You know, another country like Finland has a very different product mix, and that product mix is able to support higher salaries, a more inclusive set of institutions, so less inequality as well. And you can look at all of these product mixes that different countries make by looking at the Observatory of Economic Complexity, which is a site that we created at MIT that allows people to visualize international trade data for the last 50 years through more than 20 million visualizations.
When we look at the situation in the Eurozone, if we were to apply your tools and your analysis to what they should do over there, what would it be?
So in the context of Europe, you have an economic unit whose macroeconomic variables are in part largely determined by the economy of Germany, which is the largest and most productive economy in the Eurozone. And that means that those macroeconomic parameters, such as the exchange rate, you know, are not well adapted to countries like Spain and Italy and Greece in southern Europe that don't have the economic complexity required to sustain the levels of productivity at those prices. And therefore, what you have is actually a system that was artificially put together and has a natural tension, because as long as they're all in the same monetary union, there are going to be some economies that are pulling the exchange rate towards one direction and other ones that are requiring it to be in another direction, but they don't have the power to pull it because their economies are smaller.
This is a very optimistic book, Why Information Grows. The world, for all of its problems, is probably going in a pretty good direction. How would you characterize that optimism?
So I do believe that as we move forward, you know, we have enough of our computational capacity as a society and enough inventiveness in like small groups of people that are trying to push the envelope of what is possible to eventually find technical solutions that change the way that we behave and that we operate and we do things. And I think we are smart enough to be able to eventually evolve into a future in which we're not going to self-destruct as easily as a doomsdayer would like to believe.
Cesar Hidalgo is the author of Why Information Grows, The Evolution of Order from Atoms to Economies. He's a professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT. Thanks so much.
Thank you.